The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Turkey seeks resolution with Russia over Syria. Lobbyists seek to put more turkey on your Thanksgiving table. Todd Zwillick serves up the best meal that taxpayer money can buy later this hour. And a profile of a community college in El Paso, Texas, leading its community forward. But first, are Turkey and Russia headed toward war for the 18th time in world history, depending on whose history books you consult? A Russian warplane was taken down by Turkey over what Turkey has claimed is its airspace. And at a press conference with French President François Hollande on Tuesday, President Obama would have none of it. He insisted that Russia was being deliberately provocative in its flight patterns.
They are operating very close to a Turkish border, and they are going after moderate opposition that are supported by not only Turkey, but a wide range of countries. And if Russia is directing its energies towards Daesh and ISIL, some of those conflicts or potentials for mistakes or escalation are less likely to occur.
The president encouraged calm and cooperation between the two countries in a region that seems unable to escape the grip of war. But is that possible? Joining me now are Andrew Roth, Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post, and Frederica Geerdink, who's a journalist based in Diyarbakir, Turkey. They both join us by Skype. Andrew Roth, who's picking a fight here?
My sense of what was going on at the time is that the Turks had warned the Russians several times about flying these routes either close to the border or skirting across the border from Syria into Turkey. You know, the Turks had warned the Russians, and the Russians maybe didn't take those warnings to heart or didn't believe that Turkey would act on them, although Moscow argues that its plane didn't actually cross into Turkish airspace. So my guess is that it's somewhere in the gray zone, but that neither side really expected the other one to keep going.
Frederica?
Yes, I agree. But I think now Russia is still talking very harsh about this, accusing Turkey of aiding terrorists in Syria. And Turkey is kind of playing it down, saying, like, we only knew very late when it happened that it was actually a Russian plane. It was not an attack exactly against Russia, but just protecting our airspace. So it seems that Turkey is playing it down a little bit. But what I also think that happened on the Turkish side is that the Russian planes had been bombing an area where Turkmen are living, which is a people related to the Turks. And Turks feel very close to these people. And already in also in government newspapers in Turkey, you could see the last couple of days, like Iran and Russia are trying to annihilate the Turkmen in Syria. So we have to somehow act on this. So maybe they saw their chance, like they violated our airspace, maybe only for a very short time. But this is our way to show domestically that we care about the Turkmen and that we act when they are in danger.
Andrew Roth, do you think the Russian people are going to take this up as a nationalist issue and encourage tougher action by Moscow?
You know, it's an interesting question. For quite a while, actually, in Russian media, the question of what had happened to the pilots, had they died, had they been saved, wasn't brought up, and it wasn't addressed by officials as well. And only late last night did we start to see video of people on the ground actually shooting into the air at the Russian pilots. In what is a pretty traumatic incident, and there has been some sort of backlash in Moscow today. There was just stones and eggs thrown at the Turkish embassy here. My sense is that those incidents are still isolated, and that while we might have become used to the sort of sayings that, you know, America demands action, and we might expect in this case that Russia demands action, some sort of response, it's still very much in the hands of the Russian government.
And you've got, in both cases, Vladimir Putin, who is happy to go his own way, regardless of what the Russian people say, even though he's got a lot of popular support. And similarly with President Erdogan in Turkey, he will do whatever he likes here, and he's just gotten a mandate from successful elections. Frederico, any sense of where Erdogan might want to take this, or is he trying to stop this right now?
I think it's not really in Turkey's interest now to take it any further. They've consulted with NATO yesterday, who support Turkey, of course, because Turkey says, well, we defend our airspace and nobody will say Turkey doesn't have that right. But I think Turkey is also, well, it has to be a little bit careful too with how Russia could react to this. Maybe not in a military way directly, because I don't think that's in Russia's interest either, but maybe they could, for example, support the Kurds in Syria. That would be the way to hurt Turkey the most.
And in this general region, I mean, is it likely that airstrikes would cross a Russian airspace zone in any sense, and that Russia would have occasion to do a similar act against an allied plane or a Turkish plane? I mean, I'm not saying that that would be the case, but you know, Russia claims that things are fairly crowded there and that you have to take a tight turn across the border. Would that be the case across a Russian border?
Well, I think that right now it wouldn't be the case across a Russian border, but Russia does make one argument quite often, which is that the Syrian government has invited us to be in Syrian airspace. So the Russians today are sending very heavy S-400 surface-to-air missiles, and they're also going to be having their planes shadowed by other fighters. So the definition could be anything that seems like it's a threat to Russian aviation there. The Russians feel like they have the legal right to do that. So it wouldn't even have to cross a Russian border. This could be a case where a Russian plane feels threatened.
The president was saying yesterday in his news conference with President Hollande that Russia might be better off focusing more on the ISIS and ISIL targets inside Syria, and that if they did that, they would be nowhere near the Turks. Does that argument get a response in Moscow?
I think that the Russian response to that argument is that, you know, it's not ISIS isn't the only problem in Syria, that we're also attacking other Islamist targets. And the truth is more likely that they're attacking a wide range of targets, including more moderate groups that are opposed to Assad. Their main goal, or at least their main goal, was heavily to protect Assad at the moment. The Russians want a central role against ISIS, but they want it on their terms. And they want basically to be playing a central role with other countries, asking them for permission.
Frederica, this event, this incident seems to have revealed that there are a number of very powerful military players operating in and over Syria who have very different agendas here. Does anyone see eye to eye on what the mission is in Turkey, Frederica?
Well, there's one interesting similarity between Russia and Turkey, because both they say that they're fighting against ISIS, but neither of them actually is doing that. Turkey is mainly fighting against Assad and against the Kurds. So they are both not really fighting ISIS. And if Russia would start doing that, they would still be close to the Turkish border, because that area right along the border has some ISIS positions there. And for now, we've seen where Russia is bombing. It's not ISIS area at all, actually.
Andrew, is it the case that Vladimir Putin wants to emphasize that his mission in Syria has very little to do with the West's mission in Syria? It seems to me he's actually inflating that argument rather than being quiet about it, as the Turks are.
So I think it's important to remember that the whole reason that Russia is in Syria, or a large part of that, is so that Russia has a seat at the table in whatever happens next. So Russia and Putin are always extremely interested in emphasizing their role in whatever the Syrian settlement is going to look like in the future.
Andrew Roth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Frederica Geerding, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Roth, Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post, and Frederica Geerding is a journalist based in Diyarbakir, Turkey. It's a White House tradition, the annual Turkey pardon.
The office of the presidency, the most powerful position in the world, brings with it many awesome and solemn responsibilities. This is not one of them.
Sorry, Mr. President, but our truly awesome and solemn responsibility each year is allowing Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick to note all the political influence that brought the food to your Thanksgiving table.
The two turkeys trotting today for pardons are called Honest and Abe. So let us be honest about the National Turkey Federation's political contributions to members of Congress, shall we? They're called TURPAC, and the $10,000 they've given to Republican Texas Congressman and Chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Mike Conaway, makes him TURPAC's number one recipient in the House.
Well, I don't know why they're giving so much, other than that pretty traditional to give to the Chairman of the House Agriculture Committee. All of that money came from individuals and who were in the business of growing turkeys that you and I could buy for a stunningly low price vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
TURPAC's given lawmakers of both parties at least $119,000 already this election cycle. That's a slow year. Ahead of 2014, they gave $258,000. But then again, there was a $1 trillion farm bill getting passed that year. These days, Conaway says turkey growers have big concerns about avian flu. An epidemic last spring cost the poultry industry billions. Nearly 50 million birds were slaughtered. Commodity prices are way down now. Fruit and vegetable growers are having a harder time getting the carrots and green beans and apples to your Thanksgiving table. Even the cotton in your tablecloth is down. Conaway is the National Cotton Council's number one recipient, too. $9,000. But we're not picking on Mike Conaway. No, the National Potato Growers have a favorite in the Senate. It's Kansas Republican Jerry Moran. So I asked him about it.
Dad, I didn't even know I had a contribution for the potato growers, and I certainly have no idea how much they get.
It's $5,000, which is the largest in the Senate.
Now, there isn't a potato industry to speak of in Kansas, but Senator Moran is also on the Agriculture Committee.
The greatest input I've had from anybody interested in potatoes is from the senator from Maine, Senator Collins, who has been an advocate for potatoes. And to my knowledge, that's the longest, most extensive conversation I've had in my time in either the House or the Senate regarding potato growers.
Someone's been talking about it. Thumb through Potato Grower Magazine. They say the industry's in the middle of a big five-year federal funding boom, $80 million or more every year in state grants to promote and research potatoes. Another $80 million a year in specialty crop research into things like zebra chip disease and potato virus. Now, I don't want to single out Republicans here. TurPAC's given at least $17,000 to Democrats so far this year. Cranberries, Ocean Spray has a PAC, and they've given big to Democrats. Ron Kind of Wisconsin, Joe Kennedy III of Massachusetts, both of them got $5,000. Harry Reid got $2,500. He can use that in retirement. And he can. How do they spend it all? Mike Conaway is from a safe seat in the middle of Texas. It's hard to challenge him, but all those campaign contributions from turkey farmers, potato growers, cotton, wherever, they help keep the campaign finance system in Congress running. Powerful members like Conaway have what are called leadership PACs. A leadership PAC allows you to use your own campaign money to fund the campaigns of colleagues. And the parties also have congressional campaign committees that spend big in races. For Republicans, it's called the National Republican Congressional Committee, or NRCC.
All of the above. I have certain, as chairman, I have certain responsibilities at the NRCC to fund its operations, its independent expenditure program. So every chairman has a set amount that they have to raise during the two-year cycle. And so these donations help me meet that obligation. It also helps me target other members around the country and in Texas who are in competitive races to make sure that we maintain the Republican majority.
A tradition, you see. The president pardons the turkeys, the Turkey Federation comes to Washington, and the feast continues. Happy Thanksgiving to Honest and Abe, the White House turkeys. Happy Thanksgiving to TurPAC and the potato growers and Ocean Spray cranberries. Oh, and a very happy Thanksgiving to the Center for Responsive Politics and their most excellent website, opensecrets.org. Give them a visit for all of your PAC, Super PAC lobbying, and campaign finance needs.
Happy Thanksgiving to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwilling.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back in 2003, radio producer Dave Isay had this nutty idea to give people permission to talk about amazing moments in their lives. You would give them that permission by erecting a big room in the middle of cities and see who would come to speak from the heart.
I am recording my grandmother, and her name is Christine Terry. Say hey, Grandma.
Hey.
Share with me some of your happiest memories.
Me marrying your granddaddy. I remember it like it was yesterday. I walked down the aisle and I saw the man that made me happy. The man that just made me melt inside.
What are the keys to a strong relationship? Because you and Papa are the perfect example.
You gotta forgive, forgive, forgive. You understand?
Yes, ma'am.
That is Twyla Kelly interviewing her grandmother, Christine, but she's not in a special room. StoryCorps has gone seriously mobile. Dave Isay has launched an app to allow mediated conversations to take place on smartphones. It's an upgrade that Isay produced with his winnings from the TED Prize this year. And more than 18,000 stories have been uploaded to StoryCorps.me, where they'll be placed in the Library of Congress. This Thanksgiving, they're asking you to join in the Great Thanksgiving Listen and record a conversation with a loved one. Dave Isay, founder and president of StoryCorps, thinks this is an obvious evolution for the organization.
The whole idea of StoryCorps is that it's, you know, this public service, this human service that gives people the chance to listen to each other. And the broadcasts that we do are kind of an ancillary product of that and don't matter to us as much as that moment in the booth. And, you know, it did take us a while. And I was, you know, deeply concerned about what would happen when that StoryCorps interview experience was translated into something mobile and the facilitator was gone. That was one. The other thing was that it's expensive and we didn't have the money. So I got a call from TED a year ago saying that I had won this TED Prize. And I actually have to confess I was the last person on the face of the earth never to have seen a TED Talk. But I was very happy and it was $1 million and it was very clear that what we were going to do was build this app. And launched it a few months ago, and all my concerns were assuaged immediately. You know, the stuff that was coming in on the app, mostly from people who had never heard of StoryCorps, had no idea what public radio was, and, you know, the deep south and small towns, they were picking it up. The phone is basically a digital facilitator. It walks you through the StoryCorps experience, the app, and then you hit a button and it uploads to the Library of Congress, and they completely got it. Everybody was treating it with respect. It was like an unbelievably moving and beautiful, you know, thing to witness. And I would, you know, listen driving back and forth to the grocery store every Sunday night. And I was just, you know, blown away by the fidelity with which people were using that StoryCorps interview experience. So a few months ago, we decided to try this crazy thing where we're asking every U.S. history teacher in the country to assign their students to record an interview over this Thanksgiving weekend so that theoretically we can honor a whole generation of Americans. This is the scaling of the StoryCorps interview experience.
Dave Isay, founder and president of StoryCorps. For more on listening, be sure to tune into The Takeaway tomorrow on Thanksgiving for a special hour all about shared conversations, culture, and how to listen better.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on photo editing, public speaking, Python, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Mel, is the turkey supposed to be smoking?
First, let's give thanks to our families not being here. Who invited you?
Who invited you?
I invited all you fools.
The gods of my tribe have spoken. They have said, do not trust the pilgrims.
Gary, she's changing the words.
Thanksgiving-themed movies, since movies are on our mind for this very big movie Thanksgiving weekend. Kristen Meinzer is here, Takeaway culture producer and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, who's a film critic for Newsday and also co-host of the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
So we've got a lot to get through here, including looking forward to the Christmas movies, which are already starting to loom like giant motherships over the earth. Let's talk about the first film that is this weekend, Creed. Here's a clip.
Yeah, he's great. He's a perfect fighter. Ain't nobody ever better.
So how'd you beat him?
Time beat him. Time, you know, takes everybody out. It's undefeated. Anyway, I got locked
up. So when
up.
Mickey died, he came and talked to you, right? Talked you out of quitting, took you to L.A., trained you, brought you back.
How do you know all this?
How do you think?
What are you, like a cousin?
He's my father.
So this is an exercise in extraordinary Rocky nostalgia here. What do you think, Kristen?
Well, I have to say I went into this very skeptical because, you know, this Rocky franchise has been going on for as long as I've been alive. Do we really need a Rocky 7? And the last Rocky movie, Rocky Balboa, was just absolutely horrible. This one, we're stretching the story quite a bit. We have Apollo Creed's son, who is now grown. He's going to be a boxer. He tracks down Rocky and he says, you need to train me. I want to be a boxer. And I thought, oh, this sounds horrible. But I have to say, there's a lot of heart to this story. The training scenes are great. The boxing scenes are out of this world. I couldn't help but cheer. I loved this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm not sure I would say I loved this movie. I did like it, which I was surprised by. I was also glad to see that Sylvester Stallone is not in the ring, that he's on the trainer's stool this time, which I think is befitting his age. Michael B. Jordan, who plays Adonis Creed, I think is really good. And those boxing scenes, I have to say, are spectacular. There's
really?
One scene that is done in a single take over multiple rounds that is just a total stunner.
No
it's
kidding.
Incredible. The movie itself, a little on the wobbly side. I'm not sure I bought the story, but Ryan Coogler from Fruitvale Station is the director, and he does a very good job.
Well, if you're looking for realism, I guess the next movie is what we really ought to think about here, The Good Dinosaur, right? that'll help you out. Rafer, here's the clip.
I got a job for you.
Not really good at jobs.
I need you to keep on the dodge and sidle up the loblolly past them horn heads, just hooting and hollering and score off them rustlers. We'll cut dirt and get the bulge on them.
What? He just wants you to get on that rock and scream. But who's out there?
They'll come right at you. You hold your ground. Don't move.
Don't move? What if they have claws and big teeth?
You can kind of imagine the dinosaurs there with those very familiar, evocative voices. Rafer, what do you think?
Well, this takes place in a sort of a what-if world where the dinosaurs are coexisting with humans. That comet did not kill the dinosaurs, it passed them by. Spot is the little cave boy that befriends Arlo, the Apatosaurus. I will say this is a Disney Pixar movie, and it's one of the most technically dazzling things
really?
I think they've ever done. The backdrops, not the kind of thing you normally notice, but the backdrops, the scenery is just astounding. It's photoreal. You would not be able to distinguish it from the real thing.
That's a clue right there. If he's watching the background,
all right, so here,
what does that mean? Yeah.
And so here comes the other shoe. The story is just baffling. It's so bad that Sam Elliott there as a cattle rustling T-Rex. Arlo the Apatosaurus comes from a homesteading, corn-growing family. I don't know where The Good Dinosaur thought it was a Western, but somehow it's become this kind of oddball sort of mix of like
Focus
the Ice
group,
Age
baby.
Movie.
Focus
and,
group. We need Ice Age. We need Western. Come on.
True
put it
Brit.
All in there.
It's just, it's the weakest Pixar movie of the bunch, I have
no
to say.
Kidding. What do you think?
I have to agree and disagree with Rafer on this. I have to agree that the story is, I don't know what they were thinking. I have to disagree that this is technically dazzling. A lot of it just... It did not blow me away the way it blew Rafer away. There was a nice waterfall at one point. A river looks good. Some of the tornadoes look nice. But overall, I was so underwhelmed by this, and I cannot imagine any child today that's used to fast-paced comedy enjoying this. Our main character, Arlo, is lost for most of the movie, trying to find his way home. Most of the time, there's no dialogue. He has a human boy, Spot, as Rafer mentioned, who speaks no English, no language at all. So it's his buddy who doesn't speak at all, and him looking around and trying to find his way home. Like, is that the way home? Is that the way home?
Never finding Arlo, I guess, is the premise here.
Right.
All right, let's get to the third movie, which actually has some serious Oscar momentum. Carol, here's a clip.
I'm sure you thought it was a man who sent you back your gloves.
I did. Thought it might have been a man in the ski department.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm delighted. I doubt very much I would have gone to lunch with him.
Oh, your perfume.
Yes.
It's nice.
Thank you. Harge bought me a bottle years ago.
Harge is your husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, technically, we're divorcing.
I'm sorry.
Don't be.
So this is a period piece. It's also an acting tour de force and a real directorial piece of work here because it takes a story that is from a time before but makes it very, very relevant to today. What did you think?
Yeah, it's not just from a time before, but it's inspired by Patricia Highsmith's actual semi-autobiographical novel, The Price of Salt. And it's in the 1950s. We have Kate Blanchett playing a soon-to-be-divorced woman named Carol, and we have Rooney Mara playing a young woman named Therese who they develop a romance. And what I love about this movie are the impeccable details. The costumes, the makeup are fantastic. The acting is great. The cinematography is great. But the one thing I love the most about this is it's not a tragic lesbian story. There's so much more to this. And I don't feel that it pathologizes gayness in any way. And in that way, it seems both of our times now and completely timeless.
Well, it seems like... this is about women making choices, and that's what makes it so relevant. Rafer, what did you think?
I mean, I have to agree with Kristen. It's beautiful looking. It's directed by Todd Haynes in that Douglas Sirk mode that he loves so much. Cate Blanchett is absolutely extraordinary. It's her second Oscar-worthy performance of the year after Truth, I would say. And again, I agree with Kristen. The story does not have the kind of tragic, super tragic overtones that a lot of gay fiction and movies often do. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about the film.
And finally, The Danish Girl, which is the other sort of big picture here. Let's hear a very quick clip.
What was it about him?
I don't know. But we went for coffee. And after, I kissed him. And it was the strangest thing. It was like kissing myself.
The first transsexual. It's sort of an amazing movie. We talked about it before on the program. What did you think, Rafer?
I like this movie. It's another Oscar contender, I think. Another possible shot at the Oscar for Eddie Redmayne, who
right?
plays the lead character. I wouldn't say I love this movie. I think it has some kind of oversimplifications of the transgender issue.
What do you think?
I thought the best thing about this movie was Gerda, and the actress who plays her is Alicia Vikander, Lily's wife.
Yes.
Podcast?
We have an interview with the Danish Girl screenwriter, Lucinda Cox.
Perfect segue. Kristen Meinzer, Takeaway Culture producer, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, the Movie Date podcast. Have a great Thanksgiving, guys.
You too,
John.
Now, before we go, I want you to think about the ways in which Syrian and other Middle Eastern refugees have been spoken about in the United States in the last few weeks. Recall the comparisons of refugees to ISIS masked gunmen, the radicalized SWAT teams of terror that we are so worried will sneak into the U.S., that more than half of the U.S. governors say they want to block all incoming Syrian refugees. Now, does that image match this soundtrack? This is the theme music for a new radio series depicting life in a Syrian refugee camp. Welcome to Zaatari, as it's called. The program makes its BBC Radio debut this week, and it's a fictional account of the sometimes tragic and funny life of young people growing up in a place that is not only not home, it's not officially a place. Located an hour outside of Amman, Jordan, in Zaatari, 16-year-old Reem pines for home and dreams of continuing her education and one day becoming a doctor. There's no mention of weapons or hatred of the West here.
Walk slowly, then eat my bread slowly. Because when I finished it, well, then my favorite part of the day is over. I love the days Mother sends me to the bakery instead of just collecting UN bread. There's that Syrian smell which is someone saying, I love you. Home smelled that way at the weekends when Mother made bread.
Syrian refugee Hani Al-Sayed helped produce the original Arabic version of the radio soap with British filmmaker and journalist Charlotte Eger. Charlotte says it's her mission to humanize the refugee experience and hopes that this drama transforms how those of us in the West see ordinary Syrians.
What is absolutely key, at no time more so than the moment, is the perception of Syrian refugees in the rest of the world. And by having this drama on the BBC, absolutely prime time, and they've done us proud, prime time listening, then the stories of these completely normal, ordinary Syrian people who are very, very identifiable to people in the West, normal middle-class people who happen to have their whole lives destroyed and living in a refugee camp, those stories, their concerns, their worries can be relayed in a way which people like you and me can understand and relate to.
So, honey, is your ambition here to, at this moment, to try to affect the debate on the question of whether refugees will be accepted in the UK, in the United States, in Europe, et cetera?
Yes, I mean, I surely would hope that it positively affects the debate. It's enough that Syrians have been dehumanized within, you know, in their own country, and now they're being demonized by the international world.
Can something like this, and I'll address it to both of you, but Hani, since you really have a personal stake in this as a Syrian yourself,
yes.
Can this change things?
There is no one medium or one solution for change. It's always going to be multilateral, like in anything. But I mean, no soap opera or medium at this point, however successful it could be, could actually prevent things happening on its own. However, yes, it can help change the atmosphere, the environment of the way people are thinking, changing mindsets, social behaviors, the relationships that we have. I believe that by bringing awareness, looking at Syrians through the soap opera, these people were doctors, engineers, brothers, sisters, wives, husbands, so on and so forth. They're people. They are not the other. And I think it's important with a medium like soap operas, which, you know, it's not just about at this point with what, you know, Charlotte is doing as well, is not just about the entertainment of the soap opera within itself. It goes much further in this case where it's actually bringing awareness and there's an objective behind it. There's a message behind it. And I would hope that message would reach the Western and international communities.
Charlotte, what are the models in the UK? I suspect it's a little more diverse than the United States, but really, the models for Syrian refugees in real life in the United States consist of some pictures, some pretty gruesome pictures on the front pages of newspapers and not much else. So what are you competing with?
Well, I mean, this is one of the main problems that Syrians have is that there's sort of the two ways they're viewed now are either sort of angry young men who've been completely, you know, brainwashed and feel that they have nothing to lose and sort of join the death cult of ISIS or its affiliates, or these rather desperate, dehumanized pictures that one sees of these families crossing, you know, queuing up by the Hungarian border, walking along railway tracks. Now, I have personally been involved with three families who have crossed over to Europe in the last year. So I know some of these people. I know what they're like. I know the thoughts that were going through their mind. And when we first started doing this 2 years ago, we've been working with Syrian refugees in Jordan now for 2 years. And 2 years ago, absolutely none of them wanted to leave the Middle East and go and claim political asylum in the West. There was no question that they wanted to do that. They wanted the war to be over and they wanted to return home to Syria, where they had mainly had perfectly nice lives. And they just wanted to, frankly, stay in Jordan, be allowed to work legally in Jordan, and then one day for the war to be over, they'd be able to get into their car and drive back home again, which is only like 3 hours away. That all changed when ISIS came to power last year. People began to realise that things were not going to be the same for maybe a generation. Essentially, their old Syria had gone. And that's when the great fear began.
Let's just talk about the range of drama in a soap opera like this. I mean, you definitely want to depict normal people in real situations, but you also want to entertain people and draw them into stories where there's an exaggerated sense of drama as well, yes?
You don't need to exaggerate the drama in the refugee camp in Zaatari. I can tell you, every single person in Zaatari has undergone an experience you can make a major Hollywood motion picture out of. Every single one there. And so I realised that it had then the perfect, perfect thing that you need for a soap drama. And we've only done five episodes, but we really, really want to do this. We've had a lot of interest in extending this and doing maybe 30, 40 more episodes.
Honey, how much has the debate over refugees in Syria dismayed you or gotten your attention here in the United States?
I'm a refugee. So it definitely got my attention. I haven't seen my family in 4 years, and I'm nothing in comparison to those who are going through the different dangerous route to just reach a place where all they want is normalcy. All they want is a neighborhood, their kids to go to school, they want to work. It's part of your pride, not finding a job. It's not an issue of just finance. It's an issue of pride for many of us. And how do I feel? I feel fear where I am in the United States. I had the fortune of growing up in the Middle East in American institutions since I was in first grade up to universities. So I've got the best of both cultures. But growing up, when I looked up to the United States, I looked up to it as this is the country of courage, tolerance. It's empowered with knowledge. And today I look and I'm like, what's going on? Where's this culture of fear coming from? This is not the country that I grew up to know. This is not the country that has all the values that I grew up to know as well. And so I'm disappointed is definitely one, because I care. And I'm angry and frustrated and fearful for, you know, all the Syrians that have to take this plight. I can't get out of the United States, even if I have a refugee travel document on me right now, because I've been advised, don't go out, because you never know if the immigration officer is going to ever let you in. What we need right now is, yes, we need political solutions, and we also do need cultural reform.
Syrian refugee Honey Al-Sayed helped produce the original Arabic version of the radio soap with British filmmaker and journalist Charlotte Eger. Here's something to take with you today, a sports record. The Golden State Warriors now stand at 16-0. The defending champion Warriors now hold the best record for best regular season start in NBA history, surpassing the unsurpassable Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls. The next mountain to climb for the Warriors is to beat the all-time NBA winning streak of the 71-72 Lakers, which means they have to get from 16-33. That would put them breaking the record on January 4th in Charlotte and playing the Lakers the very next day. That'll be exciting if it happens. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great Thanksgiving. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.